Hello, everyone. Welcome to my podcast, HG, a Third Culture Kid, where I, as a third culture kid, share my thoughts, experiences, and conversations. Third culture kid is someone that grew up in a country that's different from the one that their parents are raising. That's me, because I grew up in Brazil most of my life, even though I was born in Brazil and my parents are from Korea. I was not born in Brazil, sorry. I was born in Korea. Oh, man. I'm getting better at this intro, but not quite perfect. In this podcast episode, I'm going to be doing a monologue and sharing three things that I learned over the past week. Share my thoughts, share some takeaways, share some details. And in doing this, I think by repeating what I learned, I'm going to embed this more into my memory so it serves a purpose for me. And also, I'll share the wealth of my findings to everybody who's listening to the podcast. This is what I'm about to share with you guys is based on my own interpretation, my understanding. I think I do a good job of trying to be diligent with my research, but there's risk that I might be inaccurately stating something too. So exercise your caution, exercise your discretion in whatever I'm saying. Now with that disclaimer, let's just jump straight into it. The first thing I'll talk about is HR 8. It's a gun control bill. And I first heard about this in Steve Kerr's impassioned speech at the pregame press conference, where he was urging the Senate to pass this gun control bill because he's had enough of the shootings and just moments of silence and just, I think in his perception, insufficient action by the government in preventing mass shootings. Steve Kerr is a basketball coach for the Golden State Warriors. And the second thing I'll be talking about is exposure therapy. This is a cognitive behavioral therapy strategy. And the idea is to expose you to a situation that you're fearful of, specifically that you have a phobia of. And in doing so, you build a tolerance for the situation, and you build enough of a tolerance that will be, I guess, acceptable as treatment. The third thing that I'll be talking about is a Python. Python is something I'm learning on the side. I'm not a coder by training, but I'm taking this course on Udemy called Data Science and Machine Learning. I think there's a fuller title to it, but like those are the key operative words, in my opinion, for the course title. And I'm right now 40% of the way through it. I just completed one data capstone project of that course. And I also built a program, like a 50 line code/program that automates some financial training for me. So those are the three things I'll be talking about. Regarding the first thing, HR 8. HR 8 is a federal bill that would expand background checks to private and unlicensed dealers. And in doing so, effectively, it would require background checks on all gun sales. The bill was introduced in the House of Representatives on March 1st, 2021, and then it passed the House of Representatives in March 11th, 2021. So in 10 days, which is pretty fast, especially when you consider that it's been sitting with the Senate after it passed the House of Representatives for over a year. It's right now, it's May 2021. It started sitting with the Senate in March 11th, 2021. So that discrepancy, that difference in time passage is pretty stark. And this was what was driving Steve Kerr's urgency in asking and demanding that the Senate pass this bill. It's just been sitting with the Senate for so long. I won't go into the details as to like why it's been sitting with the Senate for so long. I mean, Steve Kerr says there's like political reasons for it. And I believe there are political motives for it too. Like this is supposed to be a bipartisan bill, but I imagine and there's numbers to suggest that the Republicans wouldn't be as supportive as the Democrats would. Anyway, so that's like a little bit about the bill. And then, this bill was mentioned in his speech because of the Uvalde shooting. His response to the Uvalde shooting included this mention of HR 8. And I might be biased here, but when I heard about HR 8 from Steve Kerr, a coach that I respect and I like, I think he's a great coach for the Golden State Warriors, I thought that HR 8 was an impactful bill. But my skepticism a little bit kicked in, I guess, and I did a little bit more research. And based on my research, at the conclusion of my research, I realized that HR8 would not have been effective in preventing the gun violence that we saw in the four shootings that I recalled from the media. And the four shootings being the Buffalo, New York shooting, where a supermarket was shot up, and it was a racially charged crime. The shooter harbored hate against Black people. I mean, he specifically targeted that supermarket because it was in an area that he deemed had the most Black people in it. I don't know if it's in terms of like absolute numbers or in terms of proportion. So the Buffalo, New York shooting, the second shooting that I was aware of was the NYC subway shooting, where a man had a criminal history, went into a subway, fatally shot a passenger. He was like an investment banker and, you know, or research assistant in Goldman Sachs. The third shooting that I read from the media was Laguna Woods shooting, where a man walked in and shot up a Taiwanese American church, and only one man was killed. Fortunately, but also unfortunately, well, life was lost. And I just want to pause you just also to remember this man that got shot, because police reports, police officers that investigated this shooting said that what this man did probably saved dozens of others' lives, because he, according to witnesses, when the shooter was shooting up the church, he ran and confronted the shooter and then prevented, or kind of is incapacitated, the, like he immobilized the shooter, and the shooter wasn't, well, like was much less effective in his criminal act, and he ended up dying, and five others got injured, but nobody else died. So that's a heroic act, and this man had a family, so he had a lot to lose, and so he did lose a lot, and so that was a tremendous sacrifice. So the third shooting, Laguna Woods shooting, and the fourth shooting is a Uvalde shooting, the most recent one, where 19 children were killed by an 18-year-old man. We call him a man, but he's basically a kid. He just graduated from high school. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if he graduated from high school, but that's like around the time typically children graduate from high school. So in the four shootings, the HR8 would not have been useful. And let me explain why. In the first shooting, the Buffalo, New York shooting, the guy didn't have a criminal record. So he did go through a background check to purchase his gun, and he came out clean, and therefore he was able to own a gun. There was this incident in high school where he made a threat, he threatened murder, suicide in his school, and then he was submitted for a mental health evaluation, but then he wasn't involuntarily committed to an institution based on his mental health evaluation. If he was committed to an institution, that would have shown up on his record, and then he would have been barred from owning a gun most likely, but that didn't happen. So his background check didn't prevent him from owning a gun. HR8 would have had nil effect and barring him from owning a gun. The second shooting, like I mentioned, this guy did have a criminal history, but he stole the gun, so he bypassed a background check. So there was no opportunity for the background check to even play a role in from barring this guy from having a gun. I mean, he was from, he had an extensive criminal history, including, I think, illegal possession of a gun before, some other things. The third shooting, the man who shot up the church, he was a security guard, the very person, ironically, that you would expect to protect people, but he was a security guard, so he had successfully acquired a license to be a security guard. And in this license, I presume you have to go through a background check. And he passed his background check because he owned a gun. I mean, the gun he owned was through this security guard license. So background check, no effect. And they have barring this guy from having a gun. And so HR8 would have had no effect too. The fourth shooting, the Uvalde shooting, this guy also didn't have a criminal record. He purchased a gun from a licensed dealer, went through a background check, passed it, and therefore he owned a gun. So HR8, nil effect in the shooting. But on I did a little bit more research, but on an aggregate level, there is some evidence that expanded background checks would be impactful. So based on this website called everytownresearch.org, which is, I think is a website that's just dedicated to sharing research findings related to gun safety and guns. States that have gone beyond the federal law or the lack thereof of requiring background checks on all gun sales have experienced or have overseen a 10% decrease in homicide rates. Now, I understand that the time period that this 10% spans is probably important because that would give us an idea of what kind of confounding factors maybe should qualify the causal effect that this expanded background check that the states are enacting have on the homicide rates. But nonetheless, there's some correlation, which is some evidence of impact of having these expanded background checks. There's another one. There's another survey from 2015 that also said like 22% of gun owners that purchased a gun in the past, in the prior 2 years, they didn't go through a background check. So the statistic doesn't say that these 22% of the gun owners committed gun violence. But nonetheless, I think it shows that that's 22% of gun owners that would have gone through an additional security layer or additional verification layer. So I think that's a sizable chunk of gun owners that would have had been vetted more through a background check. And I think that provides a little bit more assurance, and a sizable one, 22%. Albeit, yes, that it's a survey from 2015, so I don't know if it applies to like 2022, but I think it's a data point. And I imagine that there's still some percentage of gun sales and gun owners that are purchasing guns without going through a background check. But 22% is the data point that we have in 2015. So in conclusion, HRA would not have been effective in preventing the four shootings that I mentioned, but there's statistics, there's aggregate evidence that suggests that there would be some impact in expanding background checks. That was my conclusion based on the research that I did. I think I condensed about like 3 hours of research. I was like reading articles, going back and forth, but I condensed about 3 hours of research into like, 12 minutes? Yeah, I'm at the 12 minute mark. Made me really think. All right, the second thing that I learned was exposure therapy. Now, I don't think I'm qualified at all to, I'm definitely not qualified at all to walk you through like how to administer it, but I would point you to the research that would explain exposure therapy in more detail, and that resource being, let me get the exact title here, it's called A Provider's Guide to Brief Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. This is an online free resource, and like based on a website that I looked up, looking at like what are the top cognitive behavioral therapy books, this was one of them. I don't know about that website's credibility, but regardless, this was one of the books. And I began reading this, and I was intrigued by this exposure therapy because the idea is to expose yourself to a situation that you have a phobia of, and then by exposing yourself to that situation in a methodical manner as prescribed through exposure therapy, you build a tolerance to that situation that you're fearful of, that you have a phobia of. And although this is prescribed for phobias, I thought it's I don't know if the issue here that this would address is like very black and white. I feel like this would still be effective on a spectrum of a fear. So instead of phobia, also like just maybe a standard amount of fear that you may have of a situation. Like it makes sense. If you expose yourself to a situation that you're fearful of multiple times, then you build a tolerance to it. So I thought there'd be lessons, exercises, methods here that would be applicable to trying to manage regular fears as well, and not necessarily phobias. Some interesting concepts. One interesting guidance point here in exposure therapy is that when you're engaging in exposure exercises, an exposure exercise is an exercise that you go through where you expose yourself to the situation or a variation of the situation that you're fearful of. I feel like in defining the exposure exercise, I was a little redundant. But a guidance, like a cautionary note in when you're doing this exposure therapy and exposure exercise, is that you do not want to engage in any like safety behaviors, which are like cognitive restructuring techniques that you learned in maybe some other cognitive behavioral therapy module, or relaxation skills. Like, you do not want to engage in those safety behaviors when you're going through this exposure exercise, because it may detract from your ability to building a tolerance to the feared stimuli. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So I think if you're in a situation that you're afraid of, that you would employ these skills that would help you manage your fear. But during the exercise, during this therapy, the specific therapy, exposure therapy itself, the guidance was that you do not want to engage in those safety behaviors, because you want to focus on building that tolerance, and doing those safety behaviors may distract you from building that tolerance. Perhaps after you conclude the therapy, when you are presented with that feared stimuli, then maybe I would go about drawing upon those techniques, but not during the therapy itself. So the unit also, another interesting feature of exposure therapy was the measurement, the unit of measurement for assessing, evaluating the success of the therapy. The unit of measurement here is SUDS, subjective units of distress. I think at the high, if you have a high subjective unit of distress, then you will have this reaction, let me see, avoidance. You'll want to avoid the situation, I believe. Module 13. Yeah. The higher the SUDS, the more you'll want to avoid the situation. So the goal of exposure therapy is to reduce your SUD level to this stimuli that you fear, that you're fearful of, to a target level that you may set. Maybe like my subjective units of distress, I think goes from a scale from 0 to 100. It might be like 80, in the situation that I fear, the situation that I fear. And then my goal may be like 40. So I would be going through the exposure therapy with a goal of like reducing my SUD level to 40. So SUDS is a unit of measurement in exposure therapy. Yeah, there's like different ways of engaging in exposure exercises, and the exposure exercise, there's structure to this. You want to engage in this exposure exercise for like a specified duration and also a specified, a certain amount of frequency. And then it might be like, you might do this over like 8 sessions, and then each session might be like 30 to 45 minutes. So there's structure to how you administer these exposure exercises. There's also like types of exposure exercises. Like one of the types, I think there's 3 types that the book mentions, but one of the types is like, a specific name is imaginal exposure, where you imagine the situation, and by imagining it, you expose yourself to that situation through your imagination, through vivid imagination. And another one is called in vivo exposure, and that's like direct exposure to the feared situation or object. So those are like some concepts there. And the last thing I guess I'll talk about in regarding exposure therapy is that they encourage you to think of a fear hierarchy. So a fear hierarchy would be like, at the top of the hierarchy would be the full-fledged unqualified situation or object that you're fearful of. And then if you go down the hierarchy, there are variations that are like lesser intense forms of that situation. So in this book, for example, if you're going to a grocery store and buying it and being around people, then maybe like going to a grocery store at like the wee hours where not a lot of people are would be like a less intense version of that situation. And the idea behind the fear hierarchy to have that, the purpose of it is to not overwhelm the person going through this exposure therapy. And to build gradual tolerance, I guess, to that feared stimuli without overwhelming the person going through that therapy and that exercise. So, yeah, so that's exposure therapy. But overall, I think there's just a lot of things in cognitive behavioral therapy that would just be valuable to anybody. Like, we call it therapy, but it's also a mental health workout, because phobias, and this exposure actually therapy is meant to treat phobias, but a phobia is an intense form of fear. So a fear and phobia, just they're on the same spectrum of fear. So I would think there would be some translatable effectiveness in exposure therapy to different levels of fear too. And same thing probably goes for other cognitive behavioral therapy strategies. Now, all right, so that's exposure therapy. Third last thing that I learned throughout the week was Python. So this data capstone project that I was doing, I was supposed to manipulate and use 9/11 call data. And a lot of it was just creating like visualizations with the data that I received that just described 9/11 calls, I think, over a certain period of time. But the takeaway pretty much was like Seaborn is a very powerful library in data visualization. A library is basically like prepackaged code that allows you to draw from code that has already been prepared by somebody else, so that you don't have to like write extensive lines of code yourself to produce a certain output. So if like for Seaborn, for example, I can like create a heat map with like one line, where if that library didn't exist, then I would probably have to write like several lines of code to replicate the heat map. So it's like prepackaged code that you can just draw from that makes your life simpler and requires less of you to produce a certain output. So Seaborn's a great visualization, data visualization package. What else? I think that's it. From Data Capstone. It was pretty straightforward Data Capstone exercise, I thought. It was really just calling Seaborn multiple times to create count plots. Count plots are it's like a bar graph counting up the instances of a category. When I created a heat map, a heat map is basically like a grid of squares, and the higher the frequency of a certain pair of two variables, like the more intense a color might be. So heat maps, what else? Oh, the apply function played a big role in this exercise as well, in this data capstone project. And I really like the apply function. Like, I use it, if every time I use Python, I try to create some sort of code, I use it quite a bit. I even use it in work, I believe. But what apply does is you would, a method is basically a function. It's a method that is applicable to data frames. A data frame is basically a table of data. But what you would do is that at least for me, I would call like the column of a data frame, and then after I call the column, and the syntax would be something like PD. PD stands for Panda. Panda is like a library, and it's a lot of what I'm using pandas for is for like data analytics. So like PD dot data frame, open parentheses, whatever your data is. Let's say I already have a data frame. So it'd be like, let's call the data frame DF. And it'd be like DF, call the column that I want to apply a function to. Let's say what I want to do is like, I want to multiply a numerical column by two. And it just has the values 1, 2, 3, 4. And I just want to multiply all those by two. What I do is I call that column DF, square bracket, open quote, numerical column name, another quote, and then close a square bracket, and then dot apply, open parentheses, and then you put in the function. You might create the function yourself, or you might call like a lambda function, and then you put in that function. I mean, I think I just type out lambda x colon 2 times x, close parentheses. And then it was basically would just multiply two to all each of the numerical values in that column. And then voila, just like that. Like there's just the apply function allows for customization of what you want to do with the data. And I really like that. I don't think you have that in SQL as easily. So the apply function is pretty cool. And then I also, during this weekend, I used the Robinhood API to create some sort of code to automate some financial trading. You can look it up. It's not that complicated. Like the method names in the Robinhood API package are a little bit long, but that's it. There's probably a limited amount of things that you can do because Robinhood itself doesn't have like extensive and like a robust set of like financial tools. And that's kind of its appeal. Like it's accessible for many people. But regardless, it's I think you can still do some stuff. Like you can create functions that allow you to buy low and sell high. There are many things. I don't know why I'm being so tentative in sharing what you can do with Robinhood API, because I've used this quite a bit. I've experimented with it for a few hours, but something's holding me back. But look it up. Look at that Robinhood API. Like you can look. You know what? I guess I just didn't want to share what I built out right away because it's still in the works. But on a basic level, I can explain what the Robinhood API does. And you can like pull information about a stock, information about a cryptocurrency, information even about like stock options, not stock options, but like option contracts. And like this information could include like what its opening price was on a certain day, what its closing price was. You can also pull like what the current price is. There's maybe some lag between what the current price actually is and what Robinhood is interpreting what the Robinhood API is extracting as the current information, just because there's delay of information naturally with anything that needs to, when data needs to pass through different channels. What else does the Robinhood API have? But that's a lot. I think that's, it'll show you what your current holdings are as well. Like how much of a certain stock you own for each of the stock you own. I mean, it's like basic stuff, but then you get all that data. And then with that data, you can then execute different functions. It allows you to buy a stock from that API. Like you can buy a stock, you put limit orders, you can put sell orders, limit sell orders as well. A limit sell order is basically like you say, you qualify your order. You say, I want to sell my stock though at this price. Nothing below this price. It has to be at least this price. And then just a normal sell order would be you just sell it at whatever the market rate is. So you can obtain information from the Robinhood API, and you can also execute actions in the Robinhood API. Yeah, I think that's good enough of a teaser for Robinhood API. Those are the things I learned over this past week. Hopefully it was helpful to some of you. And thanks for listening. All right, talk to you guys later. Till next time.